Hello, Dr. Litwa, how are you?
Good, thank you. Good to be here, Fuad.
This podcast episode is rather new, as I usually talk about philosophy of religion. But this time we are talking about history of religion because I believe knowledge about a religion history is important towards knowing how accurate we are as a religious as the religious people today with the practice of the religion when it started to exist. So yeah, I'm inviting you because I really want to know more about the beginning of Christianity. But first, can you tell us your academical background?
Of course I can. So I was educated at Emory University, Duke University, and the University of Virginia. I am now at Boston College. I have taught at a number of universities, including Virginia Tech and the Australian Catholic University. I have served as a senior research fellow. I am now trying to essentially become my own online entrepreneur. I am trying to make good, solid education in religious studies available online in a very in-depth format with real attention to detail. And essentially, I think of it as trying to, in the end, create a sort of online religious studies department that is affordable to others, cutting edge in terms of its teaching methods or pedagogy, and globally connected and accessible. So it's a pleasure to be here.
What got you into the histories of New Testaments?
Well, it's tough to say why people get into what they feel called to get into. I suppose I've always felt a certain passion for questions of religious value. They're questions which we can call questions of ultimate concern. Ultimate concern meaning it's sort of the opposite of questions that are trivial and quotidian, like what's the weather? I'm interested, was always interested in questions that had huge existential importance, like is there a soul? Is there an afterlife? Is there divine power? Is that divine power one or many? Or do people rise from the dead? What is the real energy source of the universe? And these are huge, huge questions, which, as you know, religious people answer in really, really different ways. But I always envisioned it as a kind of a way to integrate academic rigor and what the Germans call like the sciences of the spirit, Geisteswissenschaft. It's a kind of deep, deep study which takes a lot of intellectual energy, but it's also very poetical and it hits us at the deepest spiritual level. And yeah, it's transformative learning rather than just book learning and information.
How was your journey pursuing the academic study of New Testament and ancient Mediterranean religion in general?
What was the first part of your question? Sorry.
How was your journey pursuing the academic study of New Testament? Was it exciting or something like that?
The journey, Well, part of this, that's a good question because part of this is important to understand in terms of my journey. I think the academic system is broken. I think that it's in terms of my journey, it was very expensive. It was often non-supportive. It was tough for me to find a mentor. And yeah, it's one of the reasons I feel very strongly about providing, in our modern digital age, a good, strong online presence that's truly education, not entertainment. I mean, I don't mind entertainment, and I don't mind mixing a little bit of entertainment into education, but I think it's important to have that as a distinct discipline and as an offering online, you know, to really, I mean, years ago, I would be the first to say that online education wasn't as good as face-to-face education, but I think given the digital tools, we're now at a point where actually we've got a virtual world where we can, as we are here today, speaking face-to-face. And so there are tools that we can use to generate online education, generate new systems of accreditation, so that everyone, including yourself, you know, can participate in this educational system, and you don't have to, you know, spend $40,000 or $60,000 going to trying to get into Harvard or Boston University. You know, you can stay in beautiful, warm Indonesia and avoid freezing New England winters, but still get a very good education in religious studies. I mean, this is the world as it should be. And I think that I'm part of a movement which is saying we need to refine and provide good quality education online to individuals. And yeah, that's my mission.
So I think you have more excitement in pursuing your goal about, I have my own words for it. It's like a liberalizing education. So I think my content is pretty much like that. I really want to give an accessible education about philosophy and religion towards the masses. What I'm doing now is not something that I can easily achieve, information that I cannot easily achieve 10 years ago or maybe even 20 years ago. But now I'm not just know a lot of history about my religion and then Christianity. I also can talk with you face to face about that. So yeah, I think you have more excitement in pursuing that goal rather than when you're trying to study the New Testament. What do you think about that?
Well, I think they're all one piece. You know, everyone has their passion, but I think especially for me, the passion is New Testament. It is early Christianity. It's a bit broader than that. It's mystery religions. It's ruler cult, imperial worship, emperor worship. It's all different sorts of Mediterranean religious activity, including ancient Egypt and Hermetic thought. So I'm fairly broad in that sense. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to communicate this passion, this teaching passion, to an online audience. So yes, you're definitely providing a service. And essentially, I see myself as piggybacking off of channels such as yours, where I can provide the sort of next step for a lot of people who want to get academic advising online, people who want to have real solid courses online that are just as rigorous and just as precise and refined as they would get at a public university, whether in the States or elsewhere. You know, I want to create a world, or help create a world, in which you can get a really quality education without the travel, from your living room, and that's also very, you know, quality, you know, that's not skin deep. And yeah, it's all one piece of it, because, you know, I'm teaching my passion. Others will teach their passion, but we have to do it well, and we have to team up. And as I said, like, for me, it would be a great dream to create like a online religion department, which could, you know, give more than just certificates, but it could give real accreditation to students pursuing studies in theology or New Testament or religious education or world religions or any of that. So yes.
What's the reaction of your colleagues and your peers in the university when they know that you have this kind of ideas and then working towards it?
I don't know, and I'm not sure I much care. I mean, I think, as I said, the old brick and mortar education is failing. They're not able to get the enrollments. They're not able to generate a lot of interest. They are losing funding. So I think most people who are academics in colleges and universities are just trying to, they're just overwhelmed with teaching. And they're trying to keep their jobs, and that pretty much keeps them occupied. I think very few of them are looking to the broader field of online digital education. I mean, some I'm sure who might look askance at it, and I'm sure that others would be very positive and supportive. It's all, yeah, and maybe right, those responses may be right because I mean it can be done poorly or it can be done well, and I'm trying to train myself so that I can offer a really solid product in terms of online courses and academic advising. That's my whole focus. I mean, what other people think is secondary. I'm trying to provide a service to, people like the people who watch your channel and other channels who really want to go deeper. And that's why I've created a Patreon. It's why I've created online platforms of my website, my blog, webinars, courses. I've got all the ways to go, I mean, I'm growing. This is growth for me as well. But I think I'm providing a real service because people are, they're signing up, they're interested. Today, we did a webinar on redating the Gospels without apologetics. And, I've got 40 people there who are really, really interested and asking really, really amazing questions. So this is happening.
This is actually supposed to be our offline discussion, but the real reason I want to invite you here because your goal, I'm not my main goal was not to ask you about the historicity of the New Testament, Marcion or things like that, because I believe those kind of contents is already provided in your YouTube and then another your guest appearances in many history podcasts such as Myth Vision. There you have a lot of you talk in depth about those historicity. My main goal is to discuss with you actually to discuss with you about this because in Indonesia this is also a real issue. A lot of educators spend most of their time only teaching without even inspiring people and not only inspire but not to give their education accessible towards many people, and this is quite a problem here in Indonesia as well. So yeah, I'm glad that we'll talk about it at the very first, maybe the very first half of our discussion. But can you tell me the difference that you experience between teaching online like this or teach and teaching offline? What's the difference, and which one is harder?
Well, so for me, the goal is to teach both online and in brick and mortar classrooms, this roughly with equal rigor and with the same kind of quality. But of course, it has to be different. And, some of the advantages of online education, you can add certain features like interactive videos and gamification. You can add essentially visual and dramatic features that increase learner engagement. Now, those require a learning curve on the part of the teacher and professor. And unfortunately, when you get your PhD, you don't learn any of those technical skills or marketing skills. So I can perfectly understand why most professors are just either not interested or incapable of having a virtual presence. But I think they're really important skills to learn. And I think basically, I do believe in face-to-face education and in face-to-face mentoring and in creating relationships. But all those things now can also be done on an online platform. So, you know, finding ways that we can deepen the relationship and not get distracted by sort of more superficial kind of visuals or clickbait is important. The ultimate goal is really mentoring, and I think that there are platforms that allow that to happen. And ultimately, yeah, we need to create community online, and that takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of work, but I think it's worth it. And you know, hopefully in the next 10 years, it will only get better and better as we, you know, increase and improve the technology in terms of video quality and, you know, being able to assume an avatar and 3D virtual reality. I think it's very possible that within the next 10 years, we could have online platforms that basically look like classrooms, physical classrooms, but they're digital. So, yeah, I mean, it's very exciting times.
Suppose that there's someone who's interested in ancient culture, let's say a Mediterranean religion or maybe New Testament. Okay, so these people don't know what where to look at, or don't know whom to study with or what books to read. And then somehow he or she finds your channel. Of course, for them to be interested in your channel, you have to provide maybe some, you know, not clickbaity, some introductory sentences, or maybe some forewords about what will you teach there, and what kind of education that you will provide. How do you introduce yourself and make sure that those people will be interested in learning from you? How do you engage people in terms of New Testament?
Yeah, I think like anything in starting a relationship, it's about adding value. So, you know, the point of my own YouTube channel, which I hope everyone will check out, it's really an introductory opportunity for me to add value. A lot of the videos that I put up have to do with my books, whether published in the past or in the future, and so they can be used as kind of guides for reading my books and adding sort of, shall we say, introductory value. It's sort of like an initial gift that I give. And my hope is that from the YouTube channel, after you've got an introduction to the kind of quality of education that I can give you, you'll hop onto my Patreon, and there you will see a kind of value ladder where I can continue to add value to your life. You can join the Patreon for free or at a very low level and get access to posts and comments and extra videos and book reviews and article reviews, and you can get access to, you know, PDFs of my books. You can take language instruction from me, and you can design your own course with me, and you can even at the top level basically hire me as your academic advisor. So I think the point of that value ladder is to build trust. You know, you've for people who have been on my YouTube channel, you see the kind of quality education that I give, and then that takes you to the next level, where it is about supporting scholars like me, and it is important to support those who are trying to create a new future for religious studies. But you're also primarily investing in yourself. You are saying to yourself, I never had the chance to learn these things, or I had the chance and I missed it, but I'm really interested in this. I think it's really important, and I want to pursue my own education because I think that it adds to my life. And if you quality spend $60,000 for a master's degree at whatever university, I don't know. That's unfortunately what they charge here in the States. I don't know what they charge in Indonesia, but education is very expensive. So by supporting me, you're supporting a model of online education, which doesn't require you to move and uproot yourself, and you're also supporting yourself, and you're also supporting a new revolution in education, which doesn't require people to be gouged, essentially it as you said, it liberalizes and democratizes education so that even people of very small means, can afford good courses. My courses, some of them are like $30 or $40, and they're affordable even to people who are not wealthy. So that's the goal, and that's the kind of value I want to give.
My story about the Marcin story and how I found you started in 2022 when I first watched one of atheist biggest YouTubers in YouTube, where he posted a video about a guy who basically he worded it like he's the enemy of the ancient church. So that guy was Marcion, and then I became interested because of that title, that thumbnail, and how this guy presented the contents. I think you're familiar with the YouTuber. His name is Genetically Modified Skeptic. He presented a book, an essay about Marcion, and then I tried to find it. I tried to learn it more, where I finally find Myth Vision podcast, where they have you. The first thing is, by learning online, I already know a lot of things about Marcion. It is. I think it's unheard of in Indonesia, anything about that. But you cannot deny that the appeal of this educations come from maybe the presentation of the YouTubers, how he presented, and how the visual helped, and of course how he how passionate he was in trying to tell the story. Of course, he might be biased because he's an atheist, he's an ex-Christian. But of course, I think in my own experience, we have to start by saying something without have to lie about things that we know and things that we wish to educate. I really want to make my audience here engaged in a conversation about the historicity of the New Testament, and I think I'm going to start with asking you a question about that. So my first question, before I ask the first question, do you have anything to say about what I said earlier?
No, ask away. Yeah.
Okay, so the first question is, what is the most surprising knowledge you find from learning or researching the New Testament?
Well, I guess recently, it has been the constant struggle of historians to use language which is historically respectable. In my period, which is the first and second century into the third century, there simply is no New Testament. There, people don't commonly use that those terms. They don't use those terms at all, really, until the very, very late second century. So what we have is like a fluid constellation of variable texts, like waves that are constantly being modified and reproduced and added to and deleted. And no one considers them to be a united body of writings, really, until very late in, say, the 4th century, when we start getting our very first canon lists. So it's probably a little bit different than it is in Islam. It seems to me, I'm not an expert in Islam, but it seems to me like the Quran took shape as an intentional sort of book much faster than what Christians call the New Testament. What Christians call the New Testament took hundreds of years to imagine and conceptualize. So I guess, it's also a struggle, when you want to refer to New Testament documents, I try not to refer to them by their religious names, because they're not, they're really, many of them are authorless texts. They don't have listed authors, and they are not, certainly not written by apostles, and they certainly are not written by people who knew Jesus, and they probably aren't even written in the 1st century. So what I would urge people to do is, yeah, start by thinking outside the box, or maybe wipe the slate clean. And if you're interested in the New Testament, that's great. But how you should conceive of that is it's just a kind of fluid, living series of books or booklets that are never really united. And even to this day, people disagree on what should be in the New Testament. So I guess that's what I would say. I'm not sure if that's surprising or not, but I guess that's what I would, that's been on my mind recently.
How's that realization affects your faith or lack thereof?
Well, I think part of scholarship is it's not starting, if by faith we mean sort of belief in a creed or propositions such as, Jesus died and rose from the dead and sat at the right hand of the Father. These are not proper starting points for the academic study of religion. However, it is also the case that we are all driven by our passions, and so there are deeper spiritual roots to our inquiry. So, I'm not discouraging people from, seeing their historical, rigorous historical study as part of a spiritual quest. And that's a spiritual quest that even an atheist can undertake. You know, you don't have to believe in God. I always like to say that the study of the New Testament needs a few good atheists. I must take exception to the idea that Marcion Braden, I would rather not the discourse, or to use a fancy academic term, I would rather not reinscribe the discourse of the Marcion's enemies. I think we should give him a fair look and a fair shake as a type of early Christian who never intended to be an enemy of anyone, let alone other Christians, even though, yes, it is the case that many later Christians vigorously attacked him.
So what do you think about Marcion and his story in Earth?
Well, as I said, I think that we need to look at him as a Christian theologian. And I would encourage everyone, you know, to think of him as a kind of church father rather than as an enemy of the church. And I'm writing a book on Marcion, trying to revise how people normally describe Marcion. They normally describe him like his enemies described him, as a kind of theological dualist or ditheist, docetist, a deleter of scripture, a detester of Jews. And what I want to do is, all these start with D. What I want to do is I want to overturn those, what I like to call, heresiological portraits. That is, those descriptions of Marcion that are, you know, professed by his enemies. Those ideas about Marcion, one always has to ask, qui bono? That is, who benefits from that portrait of Marcion? And it's usually his enemies who are the heresy writers or the heresiologists. And what scholars have done is they have replicated or duplicated, often with, you know, the appearance of scholarly rigor, a lot of this heresiological discourse. And so I argue in my forthcoming book that Marcion was not a ditheist. He was not a deleter of scripture. He very much honored scripture and wanted to canonize it. That he was not a docetist. He believed that Jesus' body was quite solid. And that he was not a detester of Jews. In fact, he was quite happy to let Jews do their thing and have their own Messiah. And he was just interested in making sure that Christianity was not a species or form of Judaism. But that didn't necessarily mean, of course, that he hated Jews. So these are the things I'm trying to correct.
So the notion that the early church fathers canonized the New Testament was out of hatred towards Marcion. It's not true. Yeah. Before our conversation, I was thinking about that actually the canonization of the New Testament was done out of either hatred or scared because of Marcion's movement. From your last statements, I think I was wrong. What do you think about it? It's not driven out of hatred, but rather being, but more of maybe, let's say, inspired by Marcion.
I would say that's much more accurate. Yeah, it takes the early Catholics, it takes them over 2 centuries beyond Marcion to more or less agree on a canon. So to say that they are responding to Marcion is not accurate, because in Marcion's own time and in the generation after Marcion, they're not, early Catholics aren't, they don't seem to be overly concerned about issues of canon. We do have what Irenaeus calls the tetraform gospel, where he argues that there is one single gospel, but that it has four forms. But in terms of having an extended canon, they're not talking about that. And so I think what happened was that Marcion did give them the idea, an idea which they weren't quite ready for, that one should fix the Jesus tradition into a defined list of books. And so they did eventually warm up to that idea and implement it, but it took them over 2 centuries to do it. So, yeah, it's quite a complex thing.
But give me your opinion. Had Marcion himself were non-existent, he's never exist. What do you think today's Christianity would look like?
Yeah, this is a bit of contrafactual history. I think that it's quite possible that I think they would have still had many of the same rituals and eventually would have developed a canon. But I think that it would have been measurably less Pauline. Like the modern New Testament today is mostly Pauline. That is, 14 out of the 27 documents in the ancient world were considered Pauline. And Marcion is really the one who pushed the Pauline authority. So I can certainly envision a world where early Catholics had or eventually came up with a list of canonical books, but I can certainly imagine Paul not being in that list if Marcion hadn't pushed that issue. And that certainly would have had a great impact. And I think that, yeah, it's quite possible that, Christians would have lost central doctrines like justification by faith, and which would mean that, yeah, there would have been no Protestant Reformation, and religion, and then Christianity probably would not have spread. It would still be confined to Europe, maybe. So, yeah, I think that, yeah, potentially a huge impact if Marcion had not existed. Yeah.
So Marcion really thought that the God of the Old Testament is evil. Is it true?
I think he did, but he also thought that that deity was had a system of justice. He just thought that that system of justice was more like a tyranny. If you can imagine something like Putin's Russia, Russians, maybe many Russians, they love Putin, but there are some Russians who say, no, we hate Putin because he is running a system of justice, but it's all to his benefit, so that he can retain power and benefit his underlings, the so-called oligarchs, who can then run the country the way that they want and get the wealth and leave everyone else poor. That's sort of how Marcion viewed the Judean Lord, or the creator, the lower creator, I should say. He viewed him as, he has a system of justice, but it's a tyrannical system. And so the justice ends up being evil. So, it ends up killing a lot of people, it ends up being cruel to a lot of people, and it's not the system of love and peace and full goodness.
So it's not inherently evil. It's evil because of the system.
It's evil because it's selfish and it's designed for the benefit of the
The God
world.
himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Or yeah, I don't think Marcion believed that the Judean Lord was God. I think he envisioned him as a kind of middle management, as a kind of shall we say, he's a superhuman being, but he's not the universal God.
It's more like a supervisor and not the manager, maybe.
Yes, he's an underling. He's someone far below the CEO, but he's
Okay.
middle management.
Well, how did Marcin get that idea of, where did he get that idea from? Is there
Well,
any former Yeah, do continue, please.
I think a lot of philosophers of Marcion's time and deep thinkers, they also viewed the creator as a middle management kind of a figure. So that wasn't an unusual view. If you look at Alcinous and Numenius, these are contemporary Platonists who view the creator as a lower being who has made the world as best he could, but he's not the true God. He's not the good, plain and simple. He's not evil, but he's a lower being. So that's quite within the range of Platonism of Marcion's day. Yeah.
I try to think that Marcion really didn't hate that God, but more like because he was inspired by the ideas that's most common in his time. So to say that he's a God hater or a God of the Jews hater is quite misleading. What do you think about that?
I think it probably is misleading. I think that, we ultimately we can't know exactly what Marcion's actual attitude was because that's a matter of his psychology. But I see him. He certainly, I think he spoke with passion about the injustice of the creator. But I don't get the impression that, is a kind of hatred. I think that would be difficult to prove. And ultimately, I think for Marcion, that would be a waste of time. It's Marcion is trying to shape early Christian thought in a way that is productive. And I think that he exposes the injustices of the creator. But I think you can, just like any political reformer today, you can expose the injustices of a ruling dictator without, personally like hating that dictator. Of course, sometimes those two go along quite well. So ultimately, we can't really know, probably.
Do you think knowledge about Marcion should be taught in every Christian university?
Well, I do think he definitely fits in every course on early Christianity, early formation of the New Testament, courses in early church fathers, the second century apologists. I think that he should be in a lot of courses that, especially courses that focus on the Gospel according to Luke, its textual history and the Book of Acts. Yeah, just that a lot of most scholars today in the New Testament more or less keep the party line, which is not to give Marcion his due.
Right, the last question for you. Where can we find you? Your YouTube names or your Patreon page? And which book should we read if we want to know about the history of the early Christianity?
Well, definitely you can search for me on YouTube. I'm at M David Litwa. M, just it's my first initial. You can also find me on patreon.com or / M David Litwa. And of course, I have other platforms too. You can check out my website, which is simply mdavidlitwa.com, and go to my courses and webinars. There you'll also see my books, and it really depends on your interests. I suppose if you're interested in early Christianity, probably the most affordable and accessible book right now is my book called Found Christianities.
Yeah.
And that one will take you through all these figures in early Christian history who were later suppressed. And I think that they are very fascinating figures, both figures and texts.
Thank you, Doctor. I'll be sure to write the links to your pages in the description below. But before I let you go, just one last question. What does the M in your name stands for? It's M. David Litwa, right? What's
Yeah. So my first name is Matthew, but I've always gone friends by David. Yeah. I use a middle name.
So in Indonesia, if we have M, the initial M at the first of the name, it's actually very common here in Indonesia. The name M, the initial M, it stands for, most of it stands for with Muhammad, the prophet of the Islamic religion. So at the very first time when I say that, when I see that your name was M, I thought you were a Muslim. It's Muhammad David Litwa. So I was terribly mistaken. So I guess that's all, Dr. David. Yeah. So yeah, it's.
I wouldn't mind it.
why don't you mind? Why would you mind it? I mean, it's Muhammad.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that there's a lot that, and I'm hoping that because of now education is global, there'll be more chance for Christians to learn from Muslims and Muslims to learn from scholarship that is studying Christianity. And I really hope for good conversations in the future. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Litwa. I hope I can interview you the next time.
Great. Well, best of luck, and thank you for having me on.